tall grasses glistened with dew. We could clearly see the trampled grass where the whites and then Prilcop had gone down toward the town.
"Let me take your arm," Spark said to Beloved. "We need to move quickly."
"I can see, as I once did, perfectly."
"How?" Lant demanded.
"Fitz," he said quietly.
He stepped clear of the brambles and looked around him as if the world were a wonder.
"As he was dying, he did a last healing on me. I suspect it took every last bit of strength he had."
He looked down at me and added,
"I did not ask him for that. I did not want it. But he knew he was trapped. He chose to spend what life he had left on me."
I looked up at him. He was changed from the first time I had seen him. He was thinner, almost gaunt. The battering his face had taken was almost gone, and he stood differently. It came to me slowly. Nothing hurt inside him anymore. I looked away from him. I was still trying to understand what I felt when Lant spoke, his voice emptied of emotion.
"We need to get to the ship as quickly as we can. We must try to be seen as little as possible. We don't know if the white prisoners or Prilcop have rallied folk against us, so we will assume they have. Per, if we are attacked, take B and run. Don't stay to fight. Take her, hide with her, and stay there until he can get to the boat and the ship."
"I don't like that," I said bluntly. "Do you think I can't fight? Do you think I didn't fight?"
Per's angry face mirrored mine. Lant looked down on me. "It doesn't matter if you like it. My father charged me to protect Fitz. I didn't. I won't lose you too, B. Not unless I go down in my own blood. So, to make that less likely, obey me, please." He added the last words as a courtesy, with no plea in it. Per gave a tight nod, and I knew I'd have no choice. Months of being on my own. It wasn't even noon, and I was relegated to being a child again.
"I will choose our path," Beloved said.
Lant started to object, but he added,
"I once knew every alley in this town well. I can get you to the harbor, and few will mark our passage."
Lant nodded curtly, and we fell in behind him. We pushed our way clear of the brambles into a sheep pasture on a hill above the town. From our vantage, I looked down at a town that seemed unaware of any disaster. Wagons creaked through the streets. I saw a ship coming into port. The wind off the water brought me the smell of roasting meat from someone's kitchen. The wet grasses slapped against me, soaking me and slicing my bare legs as we strode on. Were the fishermen setting out for the day's work? Did they not know what I had done in the night? How could their lives be so ordinary when my father was dead? How could the whole world not be as broken as I was? I lifted my eyes to Clara's castle, and there saw thin tendrils of smoke still rising from my handiwork. I smiled. They, at least, would share some of my pain. Lant spoke. "This is odd. Don't they see that smoke and wonder what happened there?" He was silent, brows gathered in thought. I moved closer to Beloved and asked him, "Where do you think Prilcop went?"
"I truly don't know," he said,
and I heard sadness and a fear of betrayal.
"And we don't have time to worry about him."
I defended him. "He's a good man. He was kind to me. I want to believe he was really my friend."
"I know that. So do I. But good men can disagree. Severely. Now don't talk. We need to move quickly and quietly."
He led us by a roundabout path, past empty sheep pens and through a part of the town where vine-covered walls hid gardens and fancy houses. We entered a narrow lane and trotted past smaller houses and humble cottages. We came to a muddy, rutted road that snaked down to the warehouses. The streets were bereft of people.
"They'll be at the entry to the causeway, asking one another what is happening,"
Beloved predicted softly. I trotted at Per's side as the adults stretched their strides. I was barefoot, and my wet trousers slapped against my legs. A man pushing a barrow stopped and scowled to watch us pass. But he did not cry out, or point at us, or chase us.
"Run now,"
Beloved commanded us quietly, and we did. We dashed past two old women carrying baskets of vegetables and exclaiming loudly about the rising smoke. An apprentice in a leather apron ran across our path in too much of a hurry to notice us. We came to the harbour road. I had a terrible stitch in my side, but still we ran. We passed other people, but they were all going in the opposite direction, all bound for the end of the road and the causeway to Clary's castle, as Beloved had predicted. Smoke was rising from behind the castle walls, dark against a blue sky. A fleet of small fishing vessels, some with sails and some oared, were visible on the water. They came around the curve of the castle's promontory, sailing into view as calmly as seabirds. The docks rang hollow under our pounding steps. We reached the end. I bent over, gasping, my hands on my knees.
"Thank Ida and El," Lance said in a shaky voice.
I took two steps and looked down. Four sailors in a boat, three drowsing in cramped curls in the bottom. But as we clambered down, they woke rapidly and moved to take their places at the oars.
"Where's Fitz?"
one asked.
"Not coming," Lance said tersely. The tattooed warrior who had asked nodded sagely and tossed her head in the direction of the island.
"I figured that for his handiwork when I first saw the flames last night."
She stared at Beloved's face, then shook her head wordlessly. Her eyes came to rest on me.
"So, you're the little baggage all this is about."
"She is," Lance said, saving me the trouble of replying. He sounded almost proud of me as he added,
"And she's the one who set the fires."
The sailor woman tossed me a damp woolen blanket.
"Well done, Sprite, well done."
To the other sailors she said,
"Pull! I think we want to be well away from here as fast as we can."
The increasing light showed two thin trickles of smoke and one fat black one still rising. The outer walls of the keep prevented us from seeing how much damage I'd done. But I smiled to myself, trusting it was enough. There was little for them to rescue. I was certain of that. I took a seat next to Purr. Spark crouched in the bottom of the boat next to Lant. The warriors bent to their oars. The woman spoke as she pulled.
"Very late last night I saw flames. Only for a short time. Some of the folk in town came out of their houses and shouted a bit. But then the city guard turned out and chased them all back in. They shut down the taverns too. We heard all the shouting, 'Go home and stay there!' And like sheep, they all went. We pushed in under the docks and stayed quiet. We thought you'd all come running then. But no. Before dawn, I saw the lights of three boats come around the far side of the island and go to the shore. I thought they would sound an alarm, turn out the guard. But nothing."
She shrugged. Beloved sat up.
"Nothing they'd let you see. But there will be something, I fear."
His face was grim. The woman nodded.
"Lean into it,"
she told her sailors, and they rowed faster. All four were powerful rowers. They bent to their oars and their muscles bunched and slacked in unison, as if they were the muscles of a single powerful creature, rather than four separate warriors. There were several large vessels anchored in the harbour. We passed one, and then two, and finally I could see the ship we were bound for. The sails were furled, and all seemed quiet aboard it. But I saw a small figure in the crow's nest stand up and then silently scamper down the mast. The lookout raised no cry, and I suspected that was intentional. As we approached, I saw several sailors looking over the railing. We came around the side and I saw the figurehead. I could not help it. My father looked down on us, a very slight smile on his face. I burst into tears. Purr grabbed me and held me tight. His chest rose and fell against my back. But he made not a sound. No one spoke to us. I lifted my head to see Spark curled as small as a child. Lant held her, his head bent over her, as tears dripped from his chin. The rowers said nothing. Their faces were stern. I looked at Beloved. His face was carved of ice. His scars were gone, but he looked older. Tired beyond tired. Too sad to weep. Our crew brought us alongside and caught hold of an unfurling rope ladder.
"Get aboard now,"
a sailor directed us quietly, and then left us to our own devices. Spark clambered up the ladder and then stood at the side, offering a hand to Purr and then me. Beloved came behind me, as if to guard me from falling. Lant came last of us, and before he was all the way over the railing, two of our oarsmen were clinging to the ladder. A davit swung over the side and lines were lowered to bring up the boat. A sailor glanced over the side and called out softly to someone else,
"We have them! They're all aboard!"
A woman with her hair tied back in a tail hastened up to Lant.
"All went well, then?"
she asked him. Then she scowled.
"Wait, Fitz isn't here yet."
Lant slowly shook his head, and her face grew grave. I couldn't bear to listen to his telling that my father was dead. And I had another concern. I had touched the railing climbing aboard the ship, and had felt a deep thrumming of anxiety and awareness. I turned to Purr. "This ship is not made of wood," I told him, unable to explain what I'd felt.
"It's a live ship," he told me hoarsely, "made of a dragon's cocoon, with the spirit of a dragon trapped in it. The fool carved his face a long time ago to look just like your father."
He looked around. The fool was in grave conversation with the woman who had greeted us. Lant and Spark stood by them. It felt as if they had forgotten me.
"Come on,"
Purr said quietly, and took my hand. "He can't talk to you right now," he explained, as we threaded our way past sailors working a suddenly lively deck. "He has to pretend he's only wood, but you should see him." A woman passed us, talking to a man beside her.
"We'll swing him on the anchor and go quietly from the harbour. Not much wind, but enough to get us clear."
The closer we drew to the figurehead, the more uneasy I felt. My awareness of the ship was intense. I raised my walls, and then set them again, and yet again. Purr seemed unaware of the ship's roiling emotions. I tugged him to a stop.
"This ship is angry," I said.
He regarded me with worry.
"How do you know?"
"I feel it.
Purr, he scares me."
"My anger is not for you."
I felt it as if my body vibrated to that immense thought. I gripped Purr's hand so tightly he exclaimed in surprise.
"I heard what they said. They enslaved a serpent and kept it in misery to make a foul potion."
"They did. Vindaliah drank it. Then he could make people do as he said."
I was shaking all over. I wanted not to feel his immense anger. My sadness already filled me. There was no room for his fury. I tried to placate him.
"Purr killed him. Purr killed Vindaliah, and I killed the woman who gave it to him."
But my thoughts didn't quench his anger. Like oil on flames, I'd fed his fury.
"Death is not enough punishment. He took it, but others made it. Yet avengers come. I do not wish to leave until I see Clarys toppled to rubble. I will not flee like a coward."
I heard Purr gasp. I heard shouts from crewmen. But what I felt drove all other sensations away. I fell to the deck as great emotion rippled through the ship. The deck did not rock or heave. Still I clung to the planks, fearing that what I felt would be enough to throw me into the sky.
"He's changing!"
someone shouted, and Purr gave a wild, wordless cry. Under my hands, the planks of the deck lost their grain and became scaly. A terrible dizziness whirled through me and heaved my empty stomach. I lifted my head, sick with terror. Where my father's form had been, two dragon heads now wove on long, sinuous necks. The larger one was blue, a smaller one green. The blue one swiveled to look back toward us. His eyes spun, oranges and golds and yellows mingling in pools like molten metal. He spoke, his reptilian lips writhing back from white, pointed teeth.
"Purr, avenger of serpents and dragons."
I was still on my hands and knees. Purr was looking up at the figurehead, his teeth bared in a smile, or a grimace of terror. I heard running footsteps on the deck behind me, and Lant abruptly pulled me to my feet.
"There you are. I was so... B, come with me. We need to get you out of the way."
I bristled, but Per said, "I'll take her to the cabin." He pulled me away from Lant, who was gaping at the figureheads, and led me across the deck, dodging running sailors. I let him lead, paying no attention to where we went or how. Disaster was in the air. I wondered if I would ever be safe again, if I would live through the day. Per tried to deny it as he opened the door to a small, tidy chamber.
"We're going to get away, B. Once we are out of the harbor and the sails fill, we'll be clear. Paragon flies through the waves. No one will be able to catch us."
I nodded, but did not feel any relief. The ship's passion sliced through me like broken pieces of bone in my flesh.
"Just sit here. I wish I could stay, but I have to go help," he told me.
He backed toward the door, patting the air with both hands as if that would calm me.
"Just stay here," he begged me, and shut the door as he left me there.
Alone. I swayed where I sat. I could feel the ship resisting his crew. They wished to flee. He did not. It was a small cabin, untidy but not dirty. A small window, two stacked bunks and one single bunk. A woman's clothing scattered on the floor. An array of items set out on both lower bunks. I sat down on the bed, pushing aside a shirt to make room. Buck blue, my father called this color. When I moved it, a faint fragrance woke as three candles tumbled from inside it. Battered candles, impregnated with lint and dust, and cracked. But I knew my mother's work. Honeysuckle. Lilac. The little violets from our stream that fed the Withy River. I gathered them into my father's shirt as if I bundled a baby. I held them and rocked. Were they all I had left of my parents? A strange piece of knowledge grew in me. I was an orphan now. They were both gone. Gone. Forever. I had not seen him dead, but I felt him dead in a way I could not define.
"Wolf father?"
I said aloud. Nothing. The loss struck me with numbing force. My father was dead. He had journeyed for months to find me, and we'd had less than half a day together. All that was left to me were the things he had carried so far with him, things he had judged necessary, such as my mother's candles. I looked at what he had brought. I wiped my face on his shirt. He would not have minded that. I moved a pair of weather-stained trousers and saw a familiar belt beneath it. And beside it, my books. My books? That startled me. My journal of my days and the dream journal of my nights. He'd found them in my hiding place behind his study wall, and he'd carried them all those days. Had he read them? The dream journal fell open to the dream of the candles. I looked at the picture I'd painted so long ago, then let my eyes wander to the candles beside me. I understood. I closed that book and picked up my journal. I read a page, then two, and closed it. It wasn't mine anymore. It had been written by someone I had once been, but would never be again. I suddenly understood my father's compulsion to burn his work. Those daily musings belonged to someone else, someone who was just as gone as my mother and now my father were. I wanted to burn both books, give them the funeral pyre I'd never given my parents. I would cut a lock or two of my hair for that vanished child, and the man who had tried to be a good father to her. I looked at the other items scattered on the bed beside me. These were his things, I suddenly knew. Little knives and vials, his killing things, several small pouches. I smiled. I'd killed with less, and he had been proud of me. I was terribly tired, but the feelings of the ship kept washing against me in unpredictable waves. I knew I needed to sleep, and knew also that I could not. Wolffather would have told me to rest as best I could. I took the bundled candles and clambered onto the upper bunk. I lay down, but my head hit the pillow with a thud. I sat up and pushed it aside. Under a nightshirt was a glass container of something. I picked that up. It took both my hands to do so. It was heavy, and when I tipped the container, the contents shifted, moving lazily, swirling shades of grey and silver, twisting and twining. My heart sped up. I couldn't look away from it. Something in me knew this stuff, and something in it knew me. Even through the walls of the container, it reached for me, and I could not help but reach back. As I unwillingly clutched the heavy glass tube, I felt flashes of the same hot madness as when I'd cut my feet in the serpent spit. That power lurked and called just beyond the glass in my hand. I could seize this power, open the glass and drown myself in it, and I could be and do anything. I could be like Vindelire and force people to believe whatever I wished. With a convulsive shudder, I dropped it back onto the bed. I stared at it, tears forgotten. My father had carried that, had possessed that horrific thing. Why? Had he used it? Had he wanted that sort of power? I wiped my wet face on my father's shirt. He was gone, and I'd never know the answer to that question. I took the candles and threw his shirt over the glass container so I wouldn't have to look at it. I climbed down and sat on the lower bunk. I looked at my dirty feet and legs. I considered my hands, rough with work and dirty with soot. Buckkeep Castle. Would I have a place there? I could hear people running and shouting out on the deck. The motion of the ship had changed. Perhaps our time for stealth was over. Then the ship roared, a wordless cry of fear and outrage.
Fire!
That was a human cry, and I sat up, my heart leaping into my throat. I peered out the little window. Fishing boats surrounded us, but they were not fishing. They were lobbing things at our ship. I heard something break right below the window, the missile shattering as it hit. I peered out, trying to comprehend, and then I saw an archer standing up in one of the other boats. He drew back his bowstring, and another man lifted a flame to his arrow. In a heartbeat, it flew toward us. I could not tell if it struck our ship or not. Then flames leapt up across the little window, obscuring my view. I caromed across the room and flung open the door to the dim corridor. I heard the crew shouting,
"I've chopped our anchor line! Fire destroys live ships! Put it out!"
"Where is B?"
Beloved's voice. No one responded.
"Here!"
I cried out.
"B! B!"
That was Purr, and he came thundering down the companionway toward me.
"Ship's on fire! We need to get you into a boat!"
"And go where?" I shouted back at him. "To shore? Those people will catch me and kill me!" My premonition had been right. There was no safety on this ship. We had nowhere to flee. Purr and I stared at each other. My heart was thundering in my ears. A terrible scream, hoarse and deep, rang through the ship. Within the ship. Every plank in the ship screamed, and it vibrated up through my bones. Worse was the surge of pain that the ship transmitted to me. Paragon was being burned alive. The pain was not a physical one, but the anguish of a lost chance. An end to his being a ship before he ever had a chance to be a dragon. Purr reached me, seized my wrist.
"We'll decide where to go after you don't burn to death."
I tugged free and turned back toward the cabin.
"I'm not running. I have a different idea."
I clambered onto the top bunk and took up the heavy container. Purr stared at me.
"I know how to use this," I told him as it began to whisper its promises to me. "I wouldn't let the servants take me. I could command them to leap from their boats and drown, and they would do it."
"What are you going to do?"
Purr whispered in horror, then barked,
"Don't do it! Don't do anything with that stuff. It will kill you. The fool put some on his fingers, and the rain wild folk said it would kill him."
I pushed past him, the heavy glass cradled in my arms, and hurried toward the deck. His warnings didn't apply to me, I was sure. I'd seen what Vindelire did with the serpent spit. This was different, stronger and purer. I wasn't sure how to use it. Did I have to drink it? The fool had put some on his fingers, Purr had said. Did that mean I should put my hands into it, dump it over my head? I reached the short ladder that led to the deck. Before I could go up it, a man dropped from the deck, bending his knees deep to catch himself. He straightened and looked at me, pale blue eyes in a soot-blackened and flame-seared face. He was a nightmare come to life, with the hair scorched back from his brow. He looked wide-eyed at what I carried and shouted up the hatch,
"It's here! She has it!"
Another man dropped down to crouch beside him. The side of his face was blistered, and he carried one arm close to his chest. The flesh of that arm was a ruin of fat blisters and burnt shirt sleeve.
"Girl, I need that. Amber told me about it the night I rowed her into Clara's. It's for the ship. He needs the silver."
"Boyo!"
Per exclaimed in horror as he dashed up beside me. I clutched the container close to my chest. It was singing to me. Power and strength. It was mine. The ship roared again. It cascaded through the vessel and echoed in me. I could not find myself for his despair. I saw it mirrored on the faces of the men who had cornered me. The man with the burnt face spoke quickly in a shaking voice.
"Fire's spreading, Per. We can't stop it. Whatever they're using, water won't quench it. You need to get the girl off the ship now. But that silver stuff, I need it. For Paragon. He'll sink here and be gone forever, unless he can turn into dragons now. Amber told me where to find it. It's the silver Paragon was promised if he helped you."
The other man held out his hands to me.
"Please, girl, you can't use the silver. It's poison to you, but it might be enough to let the dragons break free."
If I kept it, I could make them obey me. All of them. I'd be like Vindalaya, but much stronger. I'd be like Vindalaya. "Take it." I thrust the silvery tube at them. The burnt man reached for it.
"No,"
the other man said.
"You get them off the ship. I'll get this to Paragon."
"The flames," the burnt man cautioned him. "Kennetson, you'll never get through."
"It's Paragon. This is my family ship, blood of my blood. I must."
The man called Kennetson grabbed the container, cradled it, and scampered up the ladder one-handed. Another agonizing shriek split the air and raced through the bones of the ship.
"Get up the ladder,"
Per ordered me, and I obeyed as quickly as I could. I gained the deck and stood up into the blowing smoke and falling ash. I looked up. Our furled sails were slowly burning, shedding fragments of ash and flaming canvas as they did. On one side of the ship, flame licked up in a wall. We would not escape that way. Smoke rose on every other side, and I had learned how quickly rising smoke could become a sheet of flame. My eyes streamed so that I could barely see. A gloved hand seized my shoulder from behind.
"Get to the boats!"
Beloved shouted in a gasping voice.
"There's no saving him! Oh, Paragon, my old friend!"
"Amber, where are my parents?"
The man with the injured arm shouted, and Beloved shook his head.
"They ran toward the bow. Our attackers have been concentrating the fire there. Boy, oh, you won't get through the flames. They're lost."
But the man chased after his friend with the silver. They ran forward. I saw them run. I saw them leap, and I hoped it was a thin curtain of flames they penetrated, and not an inferno. The keening of the ship filled my ears and my whole body. I shook with his fear and anger. This is how we would all end. I knew that as clearly as he did. All this I saw as I was dragged away by Beloved. He was stronger than he looked, and, in a corner of my mind, I wondered if it was my dead father's strength that he used. We reached the other side of the vessel. He looked over the side through the rising smoke and swore.
"They left us!"
Per exclaimed, and coughed. Beloved kept a grip on my shoulder. He wrapped his arm over his face and spoke through the fabric of his sleeve.
"They had to, or the boat would have caught fire too. They're there, trying to wait for us, but we'll have to jump and then swim, and the servants' boats are closing in on them."
"Lant,"
Per coughed.
"Spark?"
"I don't know."
"I can't swim,"
I said. Not that it mattered. I wondered if drowning hurt less than burning. Probably. But the fishing boats were still shooting arrows at our ships. Two of our sailors dashed up to join us, brandishing their swords futilely.
"Do we jump?"
Per coughed. His eyes were streaming. The smoke had a terrible smell and flavor, like burning flesh, like the body of the messenger my father and I had burned so long ago. Then something changed. The whole ship shuddered, like a horse shaking off flies. The deck began to buckle under our feet.
"Jump!"
Per shouted. But he gave me no time to obey. He seized me by the upper arm and dragged me away from Beloved. He did not give me time to clamber over the railing, but pulled me over it, knocking my shins hard against the wood. Strange how sharp that pain still was in the midst of everything else. Beloved leapt with us, kicking and flailing as he fell. I saw his flying body for only one instant before the cold water closed over me. I hadn't taken a breath, and Purr had lost his grip on me. I went down into cold and sudden dark. The force of my plummet pushed water up my nose. It hurt. I gasped, took in water, and then closed my mouth tight. I hung in cold darkness. Kick, kick, I told myself. Paddle hands, do something, fight to live. Wolf father? No, he was gone, with my other father, and I was alone. I had to fight, as a cornered wolf fights, as he had promised my father would fight. I kicked and slapped wildly at the water that held me. I hated it as much as I hated Dwalia and Vindalia. And then, for an instant, my head bobbed above the water. There was no time to gasp before I sank again. Kick harder, slap harder. Again I found light and the touch of air on my face. I spat and snorted water, battering my hands on the surface of the water viciously as I tried to stay above it. I gasped in air before a wave slapped me in the face. Someone caught hold of my arm. I climbed up him like a frantic cat climbs a tree, with no thought that I was pushing him under as I thrust my head into the air. I took a deep breath, and someone else caught hold of me and dragged me backward. "Relax! On your back!" a voice commanded me. The world around me was blurry. I could not relax, but she held me on my back, and the head that bobbed up beside me was Purr. He spit, snorted, and caught hold of my arm. He drew himself closer to me. "Ant, thank you." "Kick!" the girl said suddenly. "Kick hard!" I blinked salt water from my eyes. I was looking up. The ship seemed much larger from this perspective. Fire licked up his sides, and the scorched rags of burning canvas drifted up into the morning on the hot air that rose from him. I heard the dismayed and angry shouts of sailors on the other anchored ships and twisted, fearing the flotilla of little boats that had attacked us. But they seemed to be drawing back now, satisfied with their handiwork. I was kicking my feet in imitation of Purr and Ant, and we were moving away from Paragon, but slowly. The ship towered over us, slowly turning in his own inferno. I saw two more people leap through flames to seek the dubious safety of the water. His slow wallow brought the twin dragon figureheads into view. They had been blue and green, but now both were scorched and burning. The woods seemed to fight the flames. Scorched black, the scales would suddenly reappear, blue or green, but the unquenched oil would ignite again, and the flames would flare. Fire licked up the long necks. Both heads were thrashing wildly. The foredeck was engulfed in flames. Even at this distance, I could feel the waves of distress from the live ship, and his trumpets of fury and despair echoed over the bay from the rounded hills behind the town. A taller wave slapped over my face. I came up snorting and blinking water. As my vision cleared, I saw a flaming man leap onto the blue dragon's neck. He clasped it around the neck and shouted something. He held aloft my father's glass container. The dragon opened its jaws to accept it from the man. As he did so, the man fell from his perch into the sea. The blue dragon tipped its head back and closed its jaws. I saw a single silver shard fall from the dragon's mouth.
"Did it work?" Purr gasped.
"Did what work?" Ant demanded.
"Catch a line!"
someone shouted, and a rope slapped across my chest. Purr caught hold of it, and so did I. It had been thrown from one of our ship's boats. I recognized the tattooed woman who held the other end of the rope.
"There wasn't enough," Purr said sadly.
The woman began to take in line, dragging us toward the boat. The motion made the waves lap over us more strongly. Another slapped my face, and when I blinked the water away, it seemed that Paragon was falling to pieces. The masts were tilting and falling. The grand house, aft, was tipping into the bay. The railings were sagging and the planks loosening and drooping like sagging snow on branches at the end of winter. Purr spat out water. Only the hull was holding intact, and some of the deck and railings.
"Where's Amber?"
Per called to our rescuers.
Not here,
the woman said. I watched a ripple of colour run along a plank section as I clung to a line dragging me through the water. Then hands were seizing me, and I was hauled over the side and dropped into a few inches of standing water in the bottom of a crowded boat. The ribs of the boat bit mine as I thudded against them, but no one was paying attention to me. Ant and Purr were clambering aboard, legs hooked over the sides. I pulled up Purr, and then Ant.
Paragon!
Purr gasped. The wreckage of the Paragon was settling into the water. I saw someone clinging to a board and hoped it was Lant. My companions were not looking for survivors. Instead, they were transfixed by the sight of a great struggle in the water. A green head broke the surface, and then its flailing front legs caught at the wreckage. A green dragon dragged itself up onto the slowly sinking house of the ship. It spread its wings and shook water from them. Its wings were patterned with black and grey, the colours of scorched wood and dirty smoke. Abruptly, it threw its head high and gave a whistling cry. Words were mixed with her scream, for as her thoughts slapped my mind, I knew her for a queen.
Vengeance! Vengeance for me and mine!
Some of my companions covered their ears against that shrill cry, but others raised a cheer. She beat her wings more strongly, stirring the water and wreckage around her. She was not a large dragon, not much longer than a horse and team, but when she roared again, I saw her gleaming white teeth and the scarlet and yellow lining of her throat. She rose from her perch on the wreckage, fighting her way into the air until she was a green shape against a pale blue sky. She circled twice over us, and her wings seemed to grow stronger with every stroke. Then she dived onto one of the fleeing boats. I saw her snatch one of the rowers. Three loosed arrows missed her, and one bounced from her scales. She lifted the hapless man higher, and as her jaws closed, his legs fell to one side and his head and shoulders to the other. We heard our enemy's cries of horror, but no one in our boat cheered. It was too horrific. Too great a reminder of what a dragon could do to any human, even a small dragon.
A blue one!
Someone shouted. I had been so intent on watching the green one that I had missed the blue's emergence from the wreckage. He stood spread-legged upon the wallowing pile of timbers, wings of smoke veined with red, lifted wide. He was larger than the green, and the roar he gave was deep and full-throated. He tucked his head and lowered it. I did not realize the body of a man was beside him until he nosed it.
Oh, sweet Eda! That's Boyo! He's gonna eat Boyo!
As if in response to that thought, the blue dragon lifted his head again. His thoughts rode his roar, and I began to understand that I heard his speech in my mind while my ears heard his trumpet.
He lives! My friend is not my meat! I will feast on my enemies.
His wings beat more powerfully and more slowly than the green's had. He lifted deliberately into the air. Screams from across the water told me that the green was still feeding. We watched the larger blue rise. Our oarsmen were not rowing. We floated in a spreading raft of debris. Higher and higher the blue climbed, and then he dived on his prey. He swamped the boat in passing, but carried off a stout oarsman in his jaws. He carried the man up until we could barely hear his screams. Like the green had, he sheared off the dangling parts of the man. But then, in a spectacular display of agility, he swallowed and then dived again to catch the man's falling legs and gulp them in passing. The oarsmen in our boat suddenly seized their oars. I saw why. Another survivor had hauled himself up onto the wreckage. He was crawling toward Boyo's body across the bobbing planks and debris.
That's Clef! Purr shouted.
A sailor knelt in the bow of our boat, pushing debris out of our way as we made our way toward the most densely packed raft of floating wreckage. Another of Paragon's boats was swifter than we were. I saw Spark climb out to dance and balance on the floating, tipping pieces until she knelt by the man's body.
Alive!
She cried, and a cheer rose from our company. They rejoiced in the survival of their friends, in life.
I was not such a good person. I turned my eyes from the survivors and watched the two dragons harrying and chasing, feeding and soaring to let bloody bits rain down on the servants of the servants. I took my bitter satisfaction from their deaths.
Chapter 39 The Vengeance. Of the Treasure Beach, this is known. You must anchor in the small bay on the south shore. Watch the tides. A low tide will strand you. A high tide coming in may well drive you into the shore. Walk the path through the forest with caution. Disaster befalls those who wander from the path. When you reach the far shore, walk along the tide line in the bay. Do not leave the beach. All areas on Others Island are forbidden to humanity except the beach and the path. You may find treasures washed up by the waves. The currents and wind seem to gather them from afar and deposit them there. Collect as many as you wish. None may carry you away. At the correct time, a being will come to you. Treat the being with great respect. Present the treasures you have gathered. In his wisdom, the being will tell you of your future and suggest the best paths for you to follow. When the telling is done, you may leave each treasure in an alcove in the cliff. You must not take with you anything you find on the treasure beach, no matter how tiny. To do so is to invite calamity upon yourself and all your descendants. Aljani's List of Magical Places, translated by Fitzchivalry Farsia. I was amazed at the destruction two dragons could wreak, but I was certain that the remainder of the servants were even more astonished. The blue and the green drove away the small boats that had visited such disaster upon us. The other ships that had been in port raised their anchors and unfurled their sails and fled the incomprehensible destruction. They must have believed that the folk of Clarez had gone mad to visit flames upon a peacefully anchored ship. To have the ship suddenly birth two savage dragons was surely beyond their comprehension. What shall I say of that chaotic afternoon? All my memories of it are sick and sodden with salt water and grief and intense weariness. With our enemies fled, we gathered up our friends, living, dead, and those in between. Our overladen boat made it to the end of a dock, and we claimed that space. Three of our party, including the tattooed woman, seemed very familiar with battle. Deprived of weaponry, they still organized us in a defensible way and stood ready, with knives drawn. Others set out with the boat again, to find our other ship's boats and comrades clinging to the wreckage. "Will you feel safe if I leave you here and go look for the others?" Per asked me, very seriously. I shrugged. "None of us is safe, Per. This entire city hates us, and soon will find a way to show us." I gestured wide. "We have no means of escape. The ship became dragons. The other ships have fled or are destroyed by the dragons. We have few weapons and nothing to buy our lives with." It was all so clear to me. He gave me a stricken stare. I pitied him. Didn't he know we were all going to die here? "Go," I told him. "See who you can find." Before he returned, another of our ship's boats found us. Weary survivors straggled up onto the dock to join us. Spark was among them. Lant was not. Boyo was the man with the burnt face and ruined arm. Clef helped him up the ladder to the dock. I was surprised he could still speak, let alone stand.
"Has anyone seen my parents?" he asked.
No one replied. His face went slack and he sat down where he was on the dock. Slowly, he fell over. The sailor called Ant went to sit beside him.
"Have we any water?" she asked.
"We didn't." Spark came to sit beside me. She was drenched and shaking, and we huddled together for warmth.
"Amber?"
she asked me.
"Per?"
"Per is helping find the others. I don't know Amber." Spark stared blankly at me. "Amber is the fool, but only your father called him that.
or beloved?
Beloved, I said quietly.
I added, I have not seen him since we jumped from the ship. There seemed nothing else to say. We sat there. No one came to attack us. The servants' boats had scattered. Some few had fled to the castle, harried all the way by the blue and green dragons. The dragons were circling the stronghold now, screeching their anger. The archers on the walls were wasting all their arrows with shots that fell short or bounced off the scaly hide. In the town, people watched from their rooftops and the windows of the upper stories of their homes. We saw no one moving in the streets, and no one seemed to want to attack us. Perhaps the townsfolk did not even know if or why we were the enemy. The sun grew stronger in a bright blue sky, warming us and drying our clothing. I sat on the edge of the dock, swinging my bare feet over the water below, waiting. Waiting to find out who was still alive. Waiting for the townsfolk to attack us. Waiting for anything to happen at all. I'm hungry and thirsty, I said to Spark, and I wish I had shoes. That seems so wrong to me, so heartless that I can think of these things. I shook my head. My father is dead, and I'm wishing I had shoes. She put an arm around me. I found I didn't mind that. I wish I could brush my hair and tie it back from my face, Spark admitted. I wish that, even as I wonder if Lan is dead. And strange to say, I feel angry with him. That's because if you felt sad and wept, you would be making him dead in your mind. She gave me a strange look.
Yes, but how do you know these things?
I shrugged and said, I'm very angry at my father. I don't want to weep for him anymore. I know I will, but I don't want to. I rolled one shoulder, and I am very angry at beloved. Amber. I spoke the name with disdain.
Why?
Spark was aghast. I simply am. I didn't want to explain. He was alive while my father was dead. He was the one who had brought it all down on us. Beloved. The one who led the servants to the doors of Withywoods. The one who started it by making my father his catalyst. I looked at her. I asked a terrible question. Do you know about Shun?
Lan's sister, Shoin. She escaped. Your father found her. That's how he knew you'd gone through the stone.
His sister? I asked in confusion. Her smile wavered. He was as surprised as you are now. She hugged me closer, and he told me that at first you two did not get along at all. He told me a lot about you. She shook her head suddenly. I'm hungry, thirsty, and angry at Lant, and ashamed of feeling those things at all. She gave me a sad smile. When things are so immensely wrong, it seems cruel that I long for a cup of tea and some bread.
Ginger cakes. My mother used to make them for my father. I covered my mouth. My mother would be so furious with him right now.
And the hated tears welled again. A short time later, I saw one of our boats coming back to the docks. Purr was pulling one of the oars. We both stood up. There was a body in the bottom of the boat, wrapped in a piece of sail.
Oh, no, Spark moaned.
Beloved was sitting beside the wrapped corpse. They came alongside the dock, and Spark's first cry was,
Is it Lant? Is Lant dead?
It's Kennetson, Purr said in a dead voice as he looked up at us. The flames took him.
Oh!
Spark covered her mouth. I wondered if she hid her face so no one would know how relieved she was that Kennetson was dead instead of Lant. Purr climbed up onto the dock. He came to me and opened his arms. We hugged each other tightly. He looked over my head and cried out,
Not Boyo too!
He's alive,
Ant said from where she sat beside him,
but not doing well.
Boyo lifted his head and then let it drop again.
Kennetson, he said dully. He saved the ship.
It was hard work to get the wrapped corpse up the ladder and onto the dock, taking the efforts of three of them. Beloved did his share, but it seemed to me that several of his crewmates regarded him oddly. He opened the canvas and stooped over the shrouded body to compose it. Beloved shook his head wearily and looked over at me. A smile slowly curved his mouth, but his eyes were sad.
There you are. Once I saw Per, I knew you were safe.
He took two steps toward me and opened his arms. I stood still. He let his arms fall to his sides, his embrace unclaimed. He stood looking down at me.
Oh, B, I will wait. I am a stranger to you, but I feel I know you very well.
I do not think he could have said a more irritating thing. My thoughts flickered to my journal and book of dreams, now at the bottom of the harbor. No. No one could be so low as to read another's journal. Though, of course, I had read my father's papers. I looked past him and said nothing. I was aware of Spark looking at me and then regarding him with sympathy. How are you? She said, and it was a sincere question.
I am hollow inside, he said gravely. So many masks I have worn, and now they are all empty. I cannot summon even anger to sustain me. The loss is so... I want to go back there. I want to look at his body, to make it real to myself.
His words ran down. You can't. Spark spoke the word sharply. We are too few to devoid ourselves, too poorly armed, and it serves no purpose other than to prolong your pain. She looked away from him. He's dead, I said softly. I looked up at both of them. For a short time I could feel him, connected to me. I felt him, and I felt Wolffather. They are gone now. He glanced at his gloved fingers, and then cradled that hand to his chest.
I know, he admitted. But it was a terrible place to leave him, alone, with the water rising.
Do we have a plan? Spark cut in sharply. Or do we just sit on this dock until they come to kill us all? Her voice was hoarse but level. Her throat was probably as dry as mine, and her stomach as empty. I was coming to like her. She had the same steadiness that Per did, that same in-this-moment practicality. Her words snapped Beloved into a straighter posture. He looked over the huddled survivors and our thin line of protectors.
Yes, one that is subject to much change, I fear.
He pushed his damp hair back from his face.
For now, yes, we remain on this dock. We are not a large enough force to protect ourselves if we venture into the town. Here and now, we have a somewhat defensible position.
But no food. No water, no shelter from the sun. Injured folk. I did not think much of the plan of the man who had replaced my father. He folded his legs and sat down beside me. Spark copied him, and Per came to join us. Boyo remained by the body. A muscled, scarred man was looking at Boyo's arm and the blistered burns on his face and elsewhere. Suddenly, Boyo sagged to one side. The man caught him and eased him down. He had fainted. Ant had a knife and was staring off toward the town. I did not know the names of the others. There were 11 of them. One kept watch out over the harbor. The afternoon sun beat down on all of us. The tide had turned and the waves were retreating, carrying the debris of our ship with them. The other large vessels that had been in the harbor were gone, save for one that was aground and listing. Per spoke. If they come with archers as they did before, we have no cover. If they muster their courage and come by boat as well as on the shore, we will be quickly surrounded. If all they do is keep us here, we have no food, no water, no shelter from the sun. We will end here, I fear.
Those things are true, but for now, they are far too busy dealing with dragons to bother with us, and it's only to get worse for the castle and then the town.
Beloved turned his oddly pale eyes towards Clara's castle. The blue and green dragons had finished with the small boats, leaving only floating wreckage on the water. The green one was now high above Clara's castle, wings spread, rocking in the air as an eagle does when it catches the wind and effortlessly rides it. The blue was actively harrying the castle, swooping and darting in a display of flight that mocked the archer's efforts to hurt him. Arrows still flew, but there were fewer in each volley. As I watched, the blue suddenly changed tactics. Graceful as an alighting swallow, the dragon swept in and up to perch atop one of the four's towers. It was not one of the outer watchtowers that he chose, but one of the taller structures within the stronghold. The blue trumpeted loudly, as if calling to someone. Then he flung his head back and snapped it forward on his sinuous neck, mouth wide. Something sparkling flew from his open mouth. I heard distant cries.
"He spits acid in a fine spray. Nothing stands before it. Not flesh or armor or bone or stone,"
Beloved told me. I looked over at him. Hap sang to me of dragons. I know what they do. I thought of the placid, cheerful whites in their little cottages, their spotless flowing garments and picnic meals under the blossoming trees. They would be punished alongside Capra and the servants and their warrior guards. Did they deserve it? Did they know the harm their cached dreams had done to the rest of the world? I felt a twinge of pity for them, but no guilt. What was happening to them was as far beyond my control as a thunderstorm or an earthquake, or my own kidnapping and the sacking of Withywoods. The high-flying green gave a long, shrill cry.
"Vengeance!"
That was the word that rode on that sound. It echoed.
"Vengeance! Vengeance! Vengeance!"
Not an echo.
"Oh, my,"
Beloved said softly. The vision my father had given him was becoming keener. He had seen them before anyone else. Two little jewels, sparkling and twinkling in the distance. One glinted scarlet, and the other flashed bluer than the sky. Beloved lifted an arm and pointed.
"Dragons,"
he called to our companions.
"Hebe and Tintaglia, unless I am mistaken. Rapskull said they would come."
With a rattle of plumes, a crow suddenly settled on Per's shoulder. I jumped back in alarm, but he laughed joyously. She was a strange crow with a silver beak, and instead of being black, she had a glittering blue to her feathers and several scarlet plumes in each wing. And not the red of a rooster's feathers, but shining, as if polished metal could be red. Per cried out,
"Martley! I feared you drowned or arrow-shot. I am so glad you're alive. Where were you?"
The bird bobbed her head as if in agreement. Then she spoke, her voice and inflection oddly human. She opened her wings.
"I fly with the dragons!"
Full of satisfaction. She turned her bright eyes on me.
"A way out is a way in."
A shiver went up my back.
"You came to my cell!"
I exclaimed, but she paid me no mind. She had turned her head to stare up at the sky.
"Ice fire! Ice fire!"
I saw confusion cloud Per's face, but before I could wonder what the word meant, I heard him. The black dragon came, not over the sea as the others did, but from inland. He announced himself with one roar.
"Ice fire! I return, and I bring your death."
Every driving beat of his powerful wings brought him closer. He grew ever larger until he seemed impossibly big. How could such a creature exist, let alone fly? But fly he did, and as he approached the castle, we heard only his wings. Then a cry burst from him, a sound so powerful that all of us covered our ears. But while we might hold out the sound of his roar, the sense of it imprinted itself in our minds.
"Remember me, Clarez? Recall how you poisoned us with a feast of toxic cattle? Recall how you gathered to dance and sing to welcome us to your treachery? Recall how you butchered my fellows as they lay dying? How, when I fought you, you filled my mind with a curse? Bury yourself in the ice. Back then, I fled. You shamed me. You made me the last dragon in the world. But I shall not leave even one of you to recall how you all died this day.
The blue took panicked flight from the tower, a jay rousted by a raven. The black dragon did not perch. He dived on the turret of one inner tower, hitting it with his talons and the full force of his weight and impetus. It fell, tumbling like a child's blocks. I thought he would ride it down, but his great wings beat, and he lifted again. High he rose, and higher. The blue and green dragons circled wide around him, no longer actively harrying the castle. They kept their distance, and I wondered if they feared they might become his meal. Then he fell like a stone, straight down, and only in the final moment did he change his course with a shifting of his wings, driving himself against one of the skull towers. It was a sturdier thing than the graceful inner towers. Even so, it could not withstand the blow. The fearsome head tipped as if it had taken a monstrous slap. A shocking crack ran down the structure, and as the dragon clung to the skull, pushing and flapping, the crack opened wider. The skull overbalanced, and ice fire lifted away from it as it leaned ever so slowly, and then fell. Even at our distance, the sound it made as it struck the earth was impressive. From her perch on Per's shoulder, the crow opened wide her wings. A string of enthusiastic caws burst from her throat. She bobbed her head and declared,
"Dragons! My dragons!"
Per put his hands on her to prevent her from taking flight.
"It's too dangerous," he warned her. "My dragons," she insisted.
"She has finally found a flock to join," he observed to me. "Her own kind always pecked her, but the dragons have taken her in." His eyes on the dragons and their destruction, Beloved asked,
"If a flock of crows is a murder, what should we call a group of dragons?"
"A catastrophe of dragons,"
someone said, with no humor in his deep voice.
"Stay where you are."
The outcry from one of our guardians jerked my attention back to the land end of the dock. A familiar figure stood there. My heart lifted for a moment, and then I wondered, friend or foe?
"I have no weapon,"
Prilcop pointed out. I wasn't sure of that. Two of the whites we had freed from their cells stood behind him. They had recovered enough to be carrying a large bucket between them.
"I've brought you water, and I offer you shelter in a friend's home."
He turned and gestured at the two whites to bring the bucket forward. They exchanged a look, and one shook his head vigorously. They set the bucket down and retreated farther down the dock. Prilcop stared after them. Then he walked ponderously back to the bucket, took it up, and walked slowly toward us, the water sloshing over the brim at each step. We watched him come, and all I could think of was the water. He clutched the barrel of the bucket in both hands, and it was splashing on his legs and feet. I suddenly saw that he was an old man, and not very strong anymore. Behind him, in the town, people were leaving their homes, some scampering like frightened squirrels, and others moving purposefully, pushing barrows and carrying large packs as they fled. Some of them had clearly understood what Icefire was saying. I wondered if those who lived here knew tales of how the servants had killed and driven off the dragons. Had they ever imagined such a vengeance? Beloved walked past our glowering guardians, went over to Prilcop, and took the pail.
"Thank you, old friend,"
he said, and left Prilcop standing there as he brought the water back to us.
"Are you sure it's clean, not poisoned? I heard that dragon say they were poisonous."
This from the tattooed woman.
"It's not poisoned,"
Beloved assured them. He stooped and found a ladle in the bucket. He dipped up water and drank it.
"It tastes fine. It's even cool. Come and drink. Water for Boyo first."
We gave Boyo three dippers of water, and no one objected. I took one, even though they said I could have more. The guards had not given up their vigilance. I slipped closer to stand near them and hear what Prilcop was saying.
"They're destroying it all,"
Prilcop called to Beloved.
"What B began with her fire, they are finishing with acid and blows of their wings and tails."
If they do not stop, Clarez Castle will be nothing but rubble. I come to beg you to call them back. Let us change this path, beloved. Negotiate a peace for us. Help me return Clarez to what it should have been, what it once was.
Beloved shook his head, and I do not think he was sad to refuse.
Easy enough to negotiate a peace with us. Allow us to leave on the first ship that will take us. That is all we ask. We have what we came for.
Prilcop nodded.
The stolen child.
In a flat voice, Beloved added,
We can do nothing about the dragons. Their vengeance is even older than mine. They will be thorough, and nothing will stop them.
Prilcop said nothing, but his mouth sagged, and his face grew older. The blue dragon had claimed the walkway on top of the west wall. He paraded up and down it. His lashing tail raised blocks of stone, destroying the crenellation. From time to time, he threw back his head and then snapped it forward, showering the interior of the fortress with acid. I could not see the green, and then, with a wild roar, a much larger blue dragon flashed past the two remaining skull-topped towers. A smaller red one flew low over the town and then landed at the town end of the causeway. On that dragon's back was something I could not make out at that distance. A rider?
Hebe! Beautiful Hebe!
The crow cried. She tried to lift from Per's shoulder, but he caught her, his hands moving so fast I barely saw them.
Martley, she goes to battle. It is no place for you. Stay here with me, where you're safe.
Safe? Safe?
And the crow laughed a terrible cackle. Per had pinned her wings to her side, and she did not struggle. But the moment he set her back on his shoulder, she leapt from him. With two flaps of her wings, she was up and then arrowing toward the red dragon.
I come! I come! I come!
As you will, Per said sadly. Likely she is right. There is no safety here for her, or us.
The great blue dragon circled back. As Icefire had, she announced her name with a roar.
Tintaglia, she trumpeted. Vengeance for my eggs stolen and destroyed, for our serpents imprisoned and abused.
She struck the tower a lashing blow with her tail as she passed. We stared. Nothing happened. And then slowly, slowly, the skull tipped back, beheaded from its stone support. It fell, dragging half the damaged tower with it. We heard the distant crash of cascading stones.
You spent so many years at Clara's. As a child, you labored long in the scroll rooms. Your own dreams were stored there. You feel nothing?
Prilcop asked quietly.
I feel many things right now. Relief is one of them.
Beloved stared coldly at the falling walls of Clara's castle.
Satisfaction that what was done to me will never happen to another child.
And the children that were in there?
Prilcop was outraged. Beloved shook his head.
This is the vengeance of dragons. No one can stop it.
He turned to look at his friend, and his voice was terrible. The voice of a prophet.
I spent him, Prilcop. I plunged Fitzchivalry into death a dozen times. No one can know what that cost me. No one. This is my future, my path, chosen by me as the white prophet of this time. Are you so blind? He and I, we did it all. We brought the dragons back into the world.
He turned away from all of us, arms crossed on his chest. He shouted,
Servants! You made this path long before I came into the world. You set us on this rutted route to this future, when you killed and destroyed for your own comfort, when your own wealth and power were all you cared for. This is the path you created. You delayed this reckoning.
His voice dropped lower, and suddenly he was coldly calm.
But my catalyst and I have won. The future is here, and the vengeance is greater than even a prophet could predict.
His voice, so grand a moment before, cracked and broke as he said,
"Bought with his death."
The sea wind blew past him, and his pale hair stirred slightly in its passage. I did not have to touch him to see that he had been a Nexus. For one instant, all the possible paths that had been shone around him. Then they moved, converging into one bright way before it, too, exploded into a thousand paths. They dazzled my eyes, and I could not look away. But abruptly, he dropped his hands, and he was just a slender, pale man, as he asked on a sob,
"Do you think I would undo one moment of my catalyst's work?"
He knew, as I did, that it all had to end. Beloved was as much the destroyer as I had ever been. Pull out the deepest root of the weeds. I did not know I was going to do it, but I stepped forward. I took his gloved hand in mine, and we stood, staring at Prilcop.
"Will they destroy the town as well?"
Prilcop whispered in horror.
"They will,"
Beloved affirmed. Our small party had gathered around and behind him.
"Prilcop, I see one narrow path for you. Take those you have and flee to the hills. It is all you can do and all I can give you. This is a balancing of the scales that was long in coming."
He shook his head.
"It began not with me, but with the dragons, and the dragons have come to finish it."
Prilcop looked toward the castle, his hands trembling. With no fear, Beloved went to him and embraced him. He spoke quietly.
"Only for what you must feel, old friend, I am sorry. Take those you can. Guide them toward a better path."
"There were children there,"
Prilcop said brokenly. "There were children at Withywoods," I reminded him. I did not say I had been one of them.
"They have done nothing to deserve such punishment."
"And my folk were just as innocent." Could he not hear what I was telling him? Purr was suddenly beside me, his round face contorted by an anger I'd never seen before.
"Did my father and grandfather deserve to die so that you could kidnap a girl? Your people erased my mother's memories of me so that she denied me and sent me away. Neither of us will ever get past that. Do you understand that when the servants came to Withywoods, they destroyed my life as well as Bee's? And now her father is dead because of what they did."
I suddenly understood something from a long-ago dream. "Did you know that they arranged for nets to be set off Others' Island to capture and kill the serpents so that they would die and never become dragons?"
"But..."
Prilcop began. Beloved stepped back from him. His voice was harsh.
"No one deserves to die like that. But very little of what happens to us in life is what we deserve."
Still the old man stood staring at us, pleadingly.
"Prilcop, time does not pause. Go."
Prilcop stared at him as if shocked beyond words. Then he turned and stumbled away. In a few steps he recovered himself and began a dogged trot. I watched him go. Our companions looked at us questioningly, but there was nothing more to add. "Boyo is awake," I said quietly. Ant turned and hastened to his side. He was sitting up, but looked worse than he had. Beyond him, out in the water, something moved.
"What's that?"
someone demanded, drawing our attention to the other end of the dock.
"There's someone in the water,"
Spark cried. All her heart was in her shout, and with no hesitation, she leapt from the dock to swim to the man who clung to a bit of plank and doggedly kicked. We watched her go, some shouting encouragement. She reached him, and we saw her take her place beside him on the broken board. They both kicked then, and slowly, slowly, they reached a point where Boyo suddenly cried out,
"It's my da! He's alive! But where is my mother?"
He staggered to his feet, swayed, and then Ant seized his good arm to support him. The sailor called Clef dived into the water and swam toward them.
"Brash and Trell," Per said. "Paragon's captain."
His face shone with hope. Agonizing moments crawled by as they slowly drew closer. The waves pushed them toward us. Boyo stood, his burnt arm held close to his chest, his scorched face full of hope and misery. When they were close enough, Per climbed down to help first Brashen and then Clef climb out of the water. The moment the man was on the dock, he sank down and Ant lowered Boyo beside him. The father reached for his son, then drew back, not daring to touch his burnt flesh. They both wept as the captain brokenly explained that he had seen Althea briefly when the ship fell apart, but not since. He had been swimming from raft to raft of wreckage, looking for some sign of her, but found nothing. When the wreckage began to drift out of the harbor, he knew he had to try to return to shore before he was carried out with it. Too weary to swim any longer, he had clung to a plank and stubbornly worked his way back to us. Those who clustered around father and son smiled and wept. Spark, I noticed, isolated herself to sit and weep noisily, yet privately. Lant was gone. As gone as Althea, and probably others of the crew I had never met and knew nothing about. When the captain saw the carefully composed body on the dock, he gave an exclamation of both pity and despair, and Boyo began to weep afresh.
"I failed, Da. Twice I tried to get through the flames to the figurehead, but the pain drove me back. In the end, it was Kennetson who saved Paragon from dying. He claimed the silver from me and ran right into the flames. I heard him screaming, but he didn't stop. He saved our ship."
The man said nothing to try to comfort Boyo, but just let him weep. The two small dragons that had been his ship were like fluttering ribbons in the sky. Though so much smaller than the other dragons, they were just as intent on the destruction of the castle. He watched them.
"So many losses," he said.
The red dragon rampaged on the ground. The ship's dragons soon joined her. They were thorough in their destruction, moving methodically from structure to structure. They started at the houses and businesses closest to the causeway. There were no flames. The red dragon spat acid, and then, when the structures weakened, turned them to rubble with a blast of her wings or a sweep of her tail. We heard the crashes and the shouts, and the stream of fleeing folk became thicker. Some fled up into the pastures and farmland behind the town. Others pushed carts and followed the road that wound up into the hills. I sat on the dock and looked up, past the roofs of the warehouse and fine homes, to the hills beyond. People joined the sheep there and then pushed on, to vanish over the ridgeline. Slowly, slowly, the summer evening waned away. There were no flames to light the night. When Icefire and Tintaglia had finished with the castle, they joined the smaller ones in a very organized destruction of the city. There was nothing random in what they did. The ruination was as coldly calculated as anything Dwalia or Capra had visited upon me. Mothers fled with their babies in their arms. Fathers with small children in barrows or on their shoulders ran past. I watched. This was not justice at work, but vengeance. Vengeance took no account of innocence or right. It was the chain that bound horrific events together, that decreed that one awful act must beget another worse one, that would lead to yet a third. It came to me, slowly, that this chain would never end. Those who survived here would hate dragons, and the folk of the six duchies and perhaps the pirate isles. They would tell tales of this day to their descendants, and it would not be understood or forgiven. It would some day beget more vengeance. I wondered if that was a thread that was wrapped around every path. I wondered if ever a white prophet would come who could snap it. Boyo suffered from his burns and many of the others from their lesser injuries. But we dared not leave our little spot of safety while dragons walked the streets and flew over the houses. I dozed in the night, when sleep eventually triumphed over fear and discomfort. In the dawn, I woke to a place I had never been. Every structure in the town was roofless, with walls cracked and crumbled. The harbour was studded with masts of sunken wrecks. Of the piers and docks, only ours was left intact. The scene was eerie, lifeless. The streets were empty of people. I woke because Spark shook my shoulder. I sat up to see the smaller blue and green dragons advancing down the dock.
"What do they want?"
one of the guards demanded in a shaking voice. Beloved went to him and pushed aside his blade.
"They come for their own, for one they claimed as kin. Step back, for they will pass whether you clear away or not."
Brashen stood over his huddled son, for Boyo could no longer stand for the pain of his burns. Some of the other sailors retreated to the end of the dock, but Spark, Purr, and I remained where we were. The planks of the dock complained under their weight as the dragons came toward us, turning their gleaming heads on their serpentine necks and snuffing the air near Beloved. Their eyes spun like twirling silver buttons. The blue opened his mouth, the better to test the air near him.
"Tell me what they say,"
Purr breathed beside me.
"They have said nothing yet," I replied.
He took my hand in his, and I wondered if he sought to give me courage or borrow mine. It did not matter. I welcomed it. Small dragons were still very large creatures, and they were very